On this week's 51%, a genocide survivor tells her story that began in Bosnia and crossed into the U.S.
I was afraid of men in uniforms, and I was afraid of the immigration officer who was looking through my documents, because men in uniforms at the time to me meant rape and killing.
Plus, a filmmaker explores new ways of indigenous storytelling. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. In 1992, a teenager in Bihać, Bosnia, was told by her best friend they couldn't speak anymore. Her friend did not say why, but she knew the reason. She was Muslim. Amra Šabić El Reyes was 16 years old when she saw the first sign her world was changing. Then Muslim refugees from other Bosnian cities started arriving, fleeing Serbian persecution. In her new book, The Cat I Never Named, A True Story of Love, War, and Survival, she recounts her childhood during the Bosnian War. After surviving ethnic cleansing and more than 1,100 days under the Serbs' military siege, she immigrated to the United States and earned a B.A. in economics from Brown University. Later, Šabić El Reyes earned two master's degrees and a doctorate from Columbia University, where she is a professor working on understanding how and why societies fall apart and what role education can play in rebuilding decimated countries. She has published extensively on education-related issues and has lectured around the world. She spoke with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about the days leading up to the siege.
My life before the war was very much similar to teens in America today. I was a kid who loved volleyball. I was a physics and math nerd. I had lots of friends. I was even starting to fall in love. And it really seemed as in one instant overnight, the entire life that I had prior to the war collapsed. I was a Bosnian Muslim, Bošnjak, many of my friends who were Serbs, in fact, one of my best friends was a Serb, disappeared overnight. They left our city. And the military that was once our military, Yugoslav National Army, besieged the city and started to bomb us. So really the lead-up to the war was a very quick timeline for someone who was 16 at the time.
What's interesting is the way that you chose to write it, targeting a young audience. What drove you to recount this story in your 16-year-old mind versus telling your story now?
That's an excellent question. For me, in thinking about the story, really the key was to be true to myself, to who I was at that time. And as I said, given that I was a teen, it seemed natural to write for that audience, even though the book is clearly given the themes that it covers a crossover into the adult space. But there was a question that I got from my younger daughter a couple of years ago. She was in third grade at the time, born in New York City. And she came home and she said, "Mom, what will happen to me and Jana, her older sister, if you and Dad are taken away as Muslims?" And that was really the question that scared me, surprised me. It really jolted me. And it made me feel that I was not doing everything I could do as a genocide survivor, that I was abdicating my responsibility to speak out and use my story to warn America where we could end up if we opt for hate. And that was also a question that made me really think about the kind of America that I met when I first came to this country. And I'll just share with you a little detail there. I was a broken person. I was 16 when the war started, 20 when it ended, lost many family members, survived horrific scenes of violence, and I was terrified standing in the immigration line, thinking that America wouldn't want me, that America wouldn't accept someone like me. I was afraid of men in uniforms, and I was afraid of the immigration officer who was looking through my documents, because men in uniforms at the time to me meant rape and killing. And after a long time of looking through my papers and checking my documents, this immigration officer handed them to me, gave me back my passport, and he said, "Ma'am, welcome to the United States of America. I am sorry for what happened to you. You are safe now." And that moment, just telling that story every single time makes me almost cry, because that is the moment when I started to believe in humanity again. That stranger, the immigration counter, saved me. And I still believe in the possibility of that America, and that's really one of the reasons why I wrote this book.
What year did you come to America?
I came on January 17, 1996.
What was your thought process after 9/11 and the Islamophobia that kind of took hold and still has some deep roots here in the United States?
It really reintroduced, in some ways, a different kind of America for me. It was a moment when I realized that as a Muslim, I may be seen differently. And it really led to different kinds of experiences. I think prior to September 11th, I would often encounter people and share my story and say that I was a Bosnian Muslim and I survived genocide simply because I am a Muslim. And that was more of a surprise to people because of the stereotypes and biases that are really prevalent in our society, and particularly in the media, and I would say not only conservative media, but also liberal media. Statements are always made in relation to Muslims that are somehow negative and hostile, or depict Muslims as this monolithic community that has violent tendencies. And so in that sense, it was also important for me to tell the story, because during the war in Bosnia, I survived nearly 4 years under the military siege by the Serb and Serbian army. I was being killed every day, bombed every day. I starved. I didn't have electricity. I didn't have access to the outside world. I didn't have normal schooling for nearly 4 years, and a lot of kids out there and parents can relate to that feeling now. So all of that I had experienced simply because of Islamophobia, for being hated as a Muslim. And so my hope is that this book really serves as an educational platform in America to sort of reintroduce a different kind of story than what may be a prevalent perception about Muslims in the society.
Was it difficult tapping back into those memories to write this book? And how did you cater the things that you experienced to a young audience? Because war is, it's not pretty, it's not discreet. How did you tell your story?
I think there is representation of beauty and ugliness in this story, because that is the story of life and story of my life. During the war, I do fall in love for the first time, because I decided that I wouldn't die before kissing a boy as a teen at that time. But obviously there is loss and moments of violence. But I often shared my stories with my teen daughters, who said to me very frequently, "Mom, adults often tap around these issues, but we are aware of them," in the same way that I was aware of what was happening during the war, even if my parents didn't want to tell me all aspects of it. So I thought it was important to be very honest emotionally. And I have to say, it wasn't easy to do that. I knew that I had to revisit those emotional whirlpools and traumatic scenes in order to be able to really portray them accurately. But at the same time, I would say I realized very quickly into the writing process that the writing was also healing for me. It was healing because for the first time I was bringing to life a Bosnian Muslim story of a genocide survivor, but also because I grew up in a system and society where I never had a voice. In former Yugoslavia, I went through the entire educational system without once reading a story with a Muslim girl in it, with a Muslim character in it. I loved math, and I never solved a math problem with a Muslim name in it. And so in some ways, I made a Bosnian Muslim story a visible story, and I was no longer a voiceless a victim of a genocide. So the entire process brought a lot of feelings back for me, but also was extremely empowering. I felt that no longer my mouth was taped and my hands were tied, that I, for the first time in my life, really owned my story and owned the storytelling process. And I thought that was important, not only for me, but for anyone who reads this story, to experience and perhaps to identify with the aspects of my story.
You introduce a calico cat who finds her way to your family at the start of the war and remains with you like a good luck charm. Why did you decide to include the cat with no name, and how did it become the title of your book?
That's an interesting question, because I never really thought about whether I wanted to include Matsi, which means kitty in Bosnian, or not. And the simple answer to that question is really because Matsi was an integral part of our life during the war. She came to my family really accidentally. We encountered refugees in my hometown just before the siege of my city started, and I believe, I will never know for sure, but I believe that Matsi lost her family in the process, continued to follow the refugees, and she decided that she would adopt herself into our family. And we didn't want Matsi, and I'm very honest about that aspect of the story as well. I personally was afraid of everything with claws. My mother didn't want hair on the furniture, but more importantly, I think my family was deeply aware that we could barely feed ourselves. The war is about to start. We couldn't take on a responsibility for another living being. But Matsi didn't care. She adopted herself. She wanted us as her family. And just to share one moment that I describe in the book, on June 12, 1992, my city was for the first time bombed, and in the midst of it, my brother and I, during one moment, sort of escaped the basement that we were locked in with the rest of the neighbors and my family in for days. And we go back to our home to see Matsi, and in the process, we encounter four of our friends. We start talking to them, and we're looking for Matsi. We couldn't find her. We leave our friends, and as a result, my brother and I survive, but our friends are blown up in an instant. And that moment would have played out very differently if it were not for Matsi and us looking for her and leaving our friends, whose lives were ended in an instant, but we survived because of Matsi. And so there wouldn't be me, there wouldn't be my brother, there would be no story to tell without Matsi. And she continues to be really a key character in the story, but really in our life, and continues to, in sort of magical ways, save us through the war.
In speaking to a younger audience, you share the wisdom you've gained over the years. How might we counter the forces of hate that persist today?
That's a very interesting question. It's certainly a complex question, has many aspects to it. But I would say one way in which I have found in my own life, personal life, that we need to counter hate and counter stereotypes and biases is really to start to get to know each other and each other's stories more meaningfully. I don't think we have done a great job at that in this country. And early on, we talked about the prevalence of Islamophobia, for instance, as one example. We see instances of racism repeat themselves and consequences of it almost every day in our life today. And I would say that the first time I realized the storytelling was essential to building collective empathy was during the war. I had many teachers who were killed, who were injured, or simply left the country prior to war even beginning. And I was asked to teach. I was only a teen, certainly not the teacher, but given the circumstances, I started teaching in high school and also in elementary school. And that was the first moment when I really realized that sharing stories and sharing stories that students can connect to, that are relevant to their lived experiences, really brings us closer together and not only makes them more enthusiastic learners, but makes them want to be better people. And I would say that the second way in which we can, in addition to storytelling and really getting to know each other through stories like The Cat I Never Named, another way of us countering hate is not so much focusing on what someone else can do to better our lives, but really what it is that we can do to become better people. That is certainly one lesson that I deliver in The Cat I Never Named, but also a lesson that I learned during the war. I was surrounded by destruction and hate and killing, and I knew I couldn't control how much someone else hated me. I knew I couldn't stop genocide, and I think that's a shared feeling today with probably many out there who are feeling that they can't stop pandemic, they can't stop social unrest in this country and escalation of violence and escalation of hatred. But there's always something that we can't control, and that is what is internal to us. And so in the midst of all of the destruction and killing that I experienced, I decided I would better myself, not for someone else to love me, to stop killing me, but for me. And I started learning English. I taught myself English using an old dictionary. I started to work with immunization of children in my besieged city. I won several math and physics competitions in my country at the time that helped me come to the United States. And so there is always something that we can do. And I think if each one of us decides to be a better person, a better neighbor, a better colleague, I think collectively we can be a better nation. And I know that that's difficult to imagine for many people out there, but I do believe that we can get there because I know how I survived the most extraordinary time in my life, and it was by focusing on who I am, not as much of who other people are around me.
What are your hopes for readers reading The Cat I Never Named?
I would say that I do hope that anyone who hears this conversation thinks of The Cat I Never Named not only as a book that recounts a story of someone in a distant place, in a distant time, but that they realize that the story has a lot to offer to them, particularly in this moment, given what is happening in the United States. I think for most readers who have read the book so far, the typical feedback that I had received is that they thought they would read a couple of pages, but then they started to identify with the character so much that they ended up finishing a book in one reading, and that is not what they initially expected would happen. So this is a book of many surprises and many lessons that I hope will inspire not only teens, but adults as well.
That was Amra Shabich El-Reyes speaking with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about her new book, The Cat I Never Named, A True Story of Love, War, and Survival. It is published by Bloomsbury. Missy Whiteman is a Minneapolis filmmaker exploring new ways of Indigenous storytelling with expanded cinema and new technology. The Coyote Way, Going Back Home, is a two-dimensional short sci-fi film that is transformed into The Coyote Way X, expanded cinema experience. It is shot in 360 degrees, uses virtual reality, and sometimes includes video synthesizer, projection, performance, live score, and audience participation. This story was produced by Dixie Trichel.
The Coyote Way Going Back Home is a short sci-fi docu-narrative film. It's about a young boy named Charlie who has to make a decision whether or not he wants to join a street gang or go on an epic pilgrimage to find out the truth of his existence. Dose, my name is Missy Whiteman, and I belong to the Northern Arapaho and Kickapoo Nations. I make films. I'm a writer, director, producer, public artist, and muralist. When you watch the film, you see that there's actually two different realms that exist. There's this time period, and then there's also ancestral timeline, which dates back to the Wild West time, to relocation, and to boarding school era. We're so used to moving in a linear fashion when it comes to filmmaking, and we're afraid to really pull out those boundaries and say, let's just experiment with storyline, let's experiment with telling the story in the Coyote Way. People still understand that there's a beginning, middle, and end, but it may not have the exact structure that we're used to seeing. Especially coyote trickster stories, they actually lead into one another. If we really look at time, it's really a construct of Western society. It's a colonized mentality. There is no such thing as time in an indigenous viewpoint.
My name is Lewis Whitman. I played Charlie in the short film The Coyote Way Going Back Home. What makes this film so special? There's no verbal dialogue in the film, and the only form of communication is Plains American Indian Sign Language.
The Plains American Indian Sign Language is an endangered language. It's a trade language that existed amongst nations here on Turtle Island. Why I incorporated this in this film is because I felt like I wanted to ignite the spark in young people, in anyone who wants to learn this language and to pick it up and to take it to the next level. The concept of expanded cinema is taking two-dimensional film out of theaters, festivals, and different environments that aren't always accessible to everybody. So I thought about, how can we display this film and how can we make it accessible to audiences, for example, on the reservation? Now that we're looking at COVID, we do have the capacity to screen outdoors. How can we incorporate live score and performance? How can we bring it into the community? The Coyote Way X expanded cinema experience. A hybrid film includes a camera that shoots from all 360 degrees. It'll take an entire video clip of an environment. And then VR 360. Virtual reality is creating a different immersive experience. Augmented reality, AR, is a little bit different. So you're actually changing it into a new reality. So you can add animation, switch up the storyline, transform the 360 footage to make it look more bubbly or make it look more surreal. And then we're bringing in video controllerism, which is basically like a synthesizer for video. So there's different ways that 360 can be viewed or experienced. So I have the 360 on Vimeo right now. And so with Vimeo, you don't really need goggles. You can actually use your smartphone. You can use your touch screen and you can move it around and you can interact with it. And you can also move your phone around and interact with it. So moving in the next direction, I would love to have a planetarium or I'd love to have a dome for people to experience that who don't have goggles or who don't want to use goggles. And then the 360, which we haven't released yet, that's going to be a little more strategic how we want to present that. To me, it also opens up the possibilities of immersing oneself into an environment that you may not be accustomed to being in. Charlie's decision to go into the unknown, it's something that we all have to face. And so really, it's about choice and how that continues generation to generation. You're experiencing the realm that is in between sleeping and awake, life and death, and you're also experiencing Charlie's interaction with the world. Whatever it is that we're building from here on out, we can choose to build it based off of our past and to try to recreate that quote-unquote empire, or we can realize that that empire has collapsed and we're existing in a whole new world where we have a clean slate and we can now plan for the next 7 generations.
You can find more stories from Miniculture on the KFAI website at kfai.org.
100 years ago, American women won the right to vote. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. This is Women 100, a series celebrating women who made possible a century of progress. Women like Gloria Steinem, the voice of the feminist movement in the 1960s and 70s. Her skills as a reporter and activist influenced public opinion about women's equality. Steinem was born in Ohio in 1934. After earning a degree in government and a doctorate in human justice, she worked as a journalist. She gained notoriety in the early 1960s by writing about the contraceptive revolution and by going undercover and writing an exposé about being a Playboy bunny. She founded Ms. Magazine, the National Women's Political Caucus, and the Ms. Foundation for Women, the first women's fund in the U.S. Produced by WHYY with Drexel University. For more information, go to whyy.org/women100.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1632.